Welcome to the Healing Theology Podcast, where we explore the intricate connections between religion and public health. I'm your host, Alejandra Salemi, founder of Healing Theology. Each week, we bring you conversations with thought leaders, experts, clergy, researchers, and scientists who are working to bridge the gap between faith and science. Together, we challenge misconceptions, spark meaningful dialogues, and discover how these two worlds can come together to create healthier, more united societies. Thank you for joining us on this journey of Season 2. Let's dive in. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to a new season of the Healing Theology Podcast. I am super excited for the guests that we have lined up for this season and kicking off the second season with somebody that I admire a lot. Today, we have Dr. Ellen Eidler with us sharing about all of her research. I want to introduce you to her first before we get into it. I really do think she's going to help us lay some foundation for the conversations we're going to have later on in the season. And so I'm excited to have her teach us amazing things about her work in religion and public health. So Dr. Ellen Eidler is the director of Emory University's Religion and Public Health Collaboration and the Samuel Candler Dobbs Professor of Sociology. Dr. Eidler received her PhD and MPhil from Yale University, and she attended Union Theological Seminary on a Rockefeller Brothers Fellowship. She taught in Rutgers University from 1985 to 2009 in the Department of Sociology and the Institute of Health, Healthcare Policy and Aging Research as well. Dr. Eidler is a fellow and past chair of the Behavioral and Social Sciences section of the Gerontological Society of America, and was a recipient of the American Sociological Association's Matilda White Riley Distinguished Scholar Award in 2022. She studies the influence of social connections on health, the effect of self-ratings on health, on mortality and disability, and the impacts of religious participation on health and the timing of death. She's an academic editor for PLOS One and has served on the editorial boards of the American Journal of Sociology, the Journal of Gerontology, Social Sciences, and the Journal of Health and Social Behavior, Sociological Forum, and Rutgers University Press. She's also the editor of a really important edited volume that I think has been a tool for me in my research. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're one of the people that coined the idea of religion as a social determinant of health as well. So I consider you to be truly a founding mother in this general intersection of public health and religion. And I am just so honored that you're here on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Alejandra. It's been great connecting with you online. Someday I hope to meet in person, but I'm thrilled to be here. And I think that your podcast is just a really wonderful innovation, and I'm really excited to see where you go with it.
Thanks. Yeah, Dr. Eidler and I have been talking via Zoom for going on 2 years now, and we've never met in person, but she's lovely. I want to do a general check-in before we jump into some kind of headier conversations. I love to humanize my guests before we jump in. So how are you doing today?
I'm just fine. The American Sociological Association meetings start tomorrow, so I will be on a plane tomorrow going to a conference, but I'm so glad that we could do this podcast before I left.
Nice. Good luck with that conference. It's exciting. So I want to talk about the fact that you truly are a pioneer, I think, in this intersection of religion and public health. I kind of mentioned this already, but your edited volume, which is titled Religion as a Social Determinant of Health, is what I jokingly but kind of seriously refer to as my Bible in this journey through my doctoral studies. I think you've helped build and shape this intersection greatly. And so I would love to hear about how your understanding of the scholarship came about.
Well, that's sort of a biographical question. So I guess I'll go back pretty far because I think the story does go back pretty far. My dad was a Presbyterian minister, my mom a nurse. So I guess you could say I was a little bit born into religion and health. But seriously, I went to a religiously Presbyterian affiliated college, and a good number of the faculty members there were former clergy who had become PhDs. And so one of my advisor for my senior thesis was a former Methodist minister, and he had been a person who worked on the clergy consultation service, which was in the 1960s before the Roe versus Wade decision of the Supreme Court allowing abortion access to all women. Abortions were not legal in many states in the country. Ha ha. Kind of like today. But at that time, there were many clergy, and Gary Husser was one of them, my teacher, but also my father was a member of this organization who referred women to states where they could get safe and legal abortions. And so I was very interested in this organization's work because it was very profoundly public health related, but also found in, you know, in really good religious counseling for these women in their lives. And he had data, which I'm sure these days would be really like bad, but he had data on the visits that he had had with people. And after taking some courses in sociology of religion with him, I said to him, well, you know, I'll bet you that the month of pregnancy in which women come for abortion counseling is going to be later for Catholic women than it will be for Protestant women. Very simple little hypothesis that my undergraduate head put together. And I said, but this is cool because we have data here and we can actually analyze it because we know what month of pregnancy they're in, when they come for their first visit. And it was statistically significant difference. And I was totally hooked on sociological research on religion and health at that point. And I did a little presentation of that paper at the Society for Scientific Study of Religion, my first academic presentation. So I was really interested in this intersection, I guess you could say, since college. I did go to seminary for a year. I wasn't cut out for that, I don't think, in the end, but then did my PhD in sociology and did a lot of coursework in public health also at Yale, sociology and public health. So I was kind of set up for interest in both of those things from my education and my early experiences.
That's so beautiful to hear. I think I'm sure you get this question a lot of like, how did you get into this like religion and health thing? It's like a weird intersection that you kind of have to intentionally seek out. It's not something that like is known out there. I think I get that question a lot. And of the people that I've met that I've asked that question to, most of them have a very personal reason, whether it's like parents who were clergy or scientists or both like you, like yourself, or even some people like religious harm and they want to understand why institutions work the way they do. And I think there's a lot of passion in the people that are studying at this intersection, which I think is why one of the many reasons why I love it so much is that we care deeply and we have personal ties to the things that we're researching. And it's not just we threw a random dart and landed here and just picked a random topic, which is beautiful. Over the past couple of years, the interest in publications around this intersection of public health and religion, I think, has really grown. Definitely more so than it was maybe in the early 2000s or when you were doing your own studies. However, it's my perception as a young scholar that the literature, as we would call it in academia, or the published research on this intersection leans more on showing kind of the positive impacts of religion in public health. So what we would call maybe religion as a protective factor. So something that helps bolster health and helps promote flourishing. Can you help us understand whether this is a good depiction of how religion is a social determinant of health, or is that maybe just one side of the story?
Well, I don't know if it's one side, but it's certainly one part, and it's an absolutely strong part, and it's where the field started. So you're saying protective factor, but that kind of lines up also with studies that are based on individuals, individual patients or individual members of representative population samples. And so in 2022, a group at Harvard published in the Journal of the American Medical Association a systematic review and meta-analysis for some outcomes of all of the research since 2000 on serious illness and health outcomes. So that sort of sounds like a blur, but the serious illness studies were studies of patients with diagnoses of serious illness. And those studies tended to focus on the quality of life of people with serious illness. The second group was much more of the literature that you're talking about was really in the health outcomes side of this big paper. And they looked at, 35 different health outcomes, possible health outcomes, and reviewed all of the literature of good quality. And I was involved as a panelist to decide the quality of the papers that were being included in the systematic review. So I'm not an author, but I was involved with it. And they did an amazing job. It was a 2-year process that involved many people working so hard on it. Nobody's ever going to have to do that again, or maybe they can update it, but it's been done. So the findings are really, really strong. And the strongest findings were for studies of religious affiliation, or in other words, the social dimension of participation in religious groups, with all-cause mortality. So that particular dimension of religiousness, because there are many dimensions of religiousness, and that particular aspect of health, and of course, there are many ways to measure health, but that is the, there were a very large group of studies, 30-some studies, and I think in all but one, there was a statistically significant protective effect of religious participation, the social dimension, with lower all-cause mortality. And so those are really consequential and incontrovertible sets of findings that nobody can really challenge very much. So to the point about, is it a protective factor? Well, yes, in the sense of being attached to a religious group, to a social group, and increasing one's social networks, that's really important. And for all-cause mortality, which in many ways I would say is probably the most important health indicator, there's competing causes of mortality and there's lots of disease outcomes that they also studied. And there was some strong evidence for some of those cause-specific and also diagnostic health outcomes. But the strongest overall, and they did do a meta-analysis so that you could combine all of those data sets. And so I would say, just to put a pin on it, the protective effect is a very strong one when you're talking specifically about those two dimensions of religiousness and of health. So yes, but that's definitely not all of the story. It's a part of it, but it's a really important part. And to be honest with you, I would say that was where my work started. And, you know, I was interested in health outcomes. I was interested in community samples that were representative, and I was interested in religious participation. And all of the studies that I did have always shown that it's religious attendance. How frequently do you attend religious services is usually the question on the surveys. And the more frequently people attend religious services, the lower their risk of all-cause mortality is. And it's a dose response relationship in study after study over really long follow-up periods and in many, many data sets all over the world. So it's a really strong finding that I've seen in my own analyses, but also this meta-analysis would be the main source you would want to point to make that point for yourself.
Yeah, there's a lot of bits of what you just talked about, which I want to kind of dive into deeper and explain a little bit more just for people who maybe don't speak the language of scientific research in the same way. So very basic, broad stroke, but it seems like this meta-analysis that you're talking about found that the more religious you are, the lower your all-cause mortality was. So it's kind of like an inverse proportion of if you're more religious, you have a lower chance of all-cause mortality.
Be sure that you're saying attendance at religious services, because somebody could think, oh, you know, my faith is very strong or I'm a very religious person in my life. But those are kind of my ideas about myself. If they're not connected to a social group, they don't really have any protective effect. Many of the studies do have questions like that. I consider myself a deeply religious person or whatever. Those are not associated in a protective way with all-cause mortality.
Interesting. Okay. And that's maybe what you were hinting at with like the dose specific is that it's not just, oh, do you attend church or not, but it's how often, like the frequency of the number of services that you go to, the more you go to church, the lower your all-cause mortality was.
Yeah. Most of those studies would compare, you know, occasional frequency, regular or, you know, weekly attendance, and they measure it all different ways. But usually there'd be at least four levels. And they would all be compared to never attend services. And so that's the comparison group, and the never attend would have the highest mortality risk. And the others would have lower and lower until you got to the most frequent level of attendance, and they would have the least mortality risk.
Okay. I think this leads us to the next question that I have, which is talking about the socioecological model, which is a model that probably all of our listeners have heard me talk about almost every episode. But it's probably one of the more commonly used public health models that is called upon in the field. Maybe sociology also uses it a lot as well. But a quick refresher is that the model kind of looks like an onion and it starts at its core with the individual, and then it branches out into the next layer of like interpersonal exchanges, community, society, and then policy. So it's kind of this like starts at the core with you, the individual, and then it branches out from there. And it represents different layers of like the lived experience and how the individual and each layer of that onion impacts each other. I was wondering, can you walk us through how religion is a social determinant of health at the individual and interpersonal levels? And then, you know, if you see any stronger associations that are benefited there?
Well, sure. So all of these mortality analyses that I've mentioned are all adjusting for all the standard demographic, marital status and race and gender and age, and also income and education. All of those things would be considered, if they weren't in the study, it wouldn't have been good enough to be in the JAMA review. Let's just say that these were all well-controlled studies that were allowed to be in the meta-analysis. But most of those studies also have tried to see what some of the explanatory pathways are that would link religious attendance to lower mortality. And definitely one of them is health behaviors. So people who attend religious services more often are definitely less likely to be smokers. That was possibly a bigger impact in the past when more people smoked. But there is a strong association of lower smoking with higher religious attendance. And so that's a clear causal pathway that will lower mortality rates if smoking rates are lower. But that doesn't mean that it's not really about religious attendance, because there is something about religious attendance that encourages people's better health behaviors. And other studies have shown that people who attend religious services more often get more preventive healthcare visits. They eat a better diet. They are likely to sleep more. They exercise more. And so a whole group of health behaviors are shown to be better among people with religious attendance and those kinds of social ties and connections. And that's a causal pathway, right? That is one way that this background factor leads through these different behavioral mechanisms to the outcome of mortality. And also, and even more important, because I'm a sociologist and not a behavioral scientist, is the social network expansion that comes with attendance at religious services means that people have ties to others in their community that they would not know from their work or their family or the people who live on their block. Those are all ways that we have social network ties to our communities. But religious groups bring in lots of other people that we wouldn't meet any other way. And often people who are really different from us and who enrich our world so tremendously because they're not in the sort of narrow strata of work and education and the way we are all kind of slotted into our roles in society. It broadens them. And one of my favorite things to say in talks is there is no intergenerational group that people can regularly participate in other than, I mean, families, I guess. Families are intergenerational, but we don't see all of our family generations once a week. But if you go to a religious service, you'll see babies and little kids and teenagers and young adults and older adults and very elderly people. And they're all there with an equal status, every single one of them. And I think that intergenerational tie and the connections to the entire life course is a really important aspect of religious group membership. So that's another causal pathway. I mean, I think we've known, social epidemiology has told us since 1979, when the first paper was published, that the more social ties people have, the more protected they are against mortality. And so this is just another, this is an enhancement of the social ties, but it is a special kind of social tie that isn't really duplicated by any of the others. So that's why I think it's especially important to say.
Well, and I, as you were talking and describing this kind of ideal faith community, it feels like that to me is the dream church or faith community structure, right? Is having something that like allows you to interact with people of a different profession, of a different socioeconomic status, of a different race and gender and age as you. And I think ideally that's what it would be. And I think that maybe I would wonder as a sociologist what you would think of how ideally a church would look like is not actually what is happening right now in church society. I think with the rise of Christian nationalism and a lot more like extremist and polarizing ideology, maybe it's a reminder of like there is a way that the church could be present and actually be a really important aid in helping communities flourish, and how at times there's churches and religious communities who are kind of dropping the ball there and allowing for it to become actually this like echo chamber of polarization instead.
I totally worry about all those things. And at the same time, I'm a member of a church just like that. So that's the one I see every Sunday. But yeah, I don't dismiss your words at all. But there is a possibility, I think, for some kinds of common ground to be found. I think those are some of the topics we're going to move to in a minute. But I think that as our communities shred, that people who have some opportunity to find common ground with each other, even if it is somewhat limited, still is a thread, a strength of tying us together in a way that we desperately need.
Yeah, let's move on into that like tough conversation. So We've talked about the personal and interpersonal layer of the model. Let's talk about the community and society level. So you published a commentary in the British Medical Journal last year. I'll link it in the show notes, which I think was really, really powerful. And in that commentary, you talked about the complexities and contradictions of religion's impact on health outcomes. So you said religion shapes people's health worlds. First of all, can you help us define what health worlds are and then how religion actually impacts those health worlds?
Sure. I am definitely not drawing on my own work here, but that of one of the co-authors of the paper. So the wonderful co-authors on that paper last summer were John Blevins, my colleague at Emory in Global Health, and Mohamed Jallo, who is the CDC country director for Tanzania. And an expert, especially on vaccinations and child health. He's amazing. And then the person who is the health world person is Jim Cochran, an emeritus professor of the University of Cape Town in South Africa. So Jim and John were both authors of chapters in the Religion as a Social Determinant of Health edited volume. I hadn't met Mohammed at that point, but now I know him. Anyway, so the term health worlds comes from work that Jim had done with others in South Africa, particularly a sociologist named Paul Germond. And if you wanted, I could link to the paper that they wrote that is about health worlds. But if I can relay their thinking about this, and certainly Jim wrote that sentence of the paper, but it starts by saying that in the work that they were doing in Lesotho, they found that in the native language, that the word religion and the word health were the same thing. There was no way to distinguish those two things. So they couldn't ask people about those two things because there wasn't two things. There was only one thing. And the term is bophelo, B-O-P-H-E-L-O. And this was the word that encompassed both the ideas of religion and health. And it is a very, as they spell it out in this article, it encompasses the health of individuals, but you can't just think about the health of individuals separately from the health of their families and their communities and their, you know, their larger and larger communities. So bophelo is a very holistic term for health that encompasses both faith and health, and the faith part of it can't be left out. So that's my best attempt to explain health worlds to you. But I'll be happy to share that link with you if you would like to let your readers know about it. It's an article that was in the British Journal of Sociology.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. I love that word encompasses both aspects of health. That is, I think, one of my biggest goals is to highlight how we cannot separate one from the other. Our physical, mental, and spiritual health are all interconnected. If you're enjoying today's discussion, don't forget to subscribe to the Healing Theology podcast on your favorite streaming platform. You can also visit us at healingtheology.com for more resources, show notes, and to join our growing community. You can also find us on social media at Healing Theology on all major social media platforms. Now, let's get back to our conversation. Can you help us understand how religion impacts community and the society levels of our lives and kind of some of the things that you were hinting at in the commentary in the British Medical Journal?
So I was very honored to be asked to write that. I think they call them analytic essays by the British Medical Journal. And at the time, I was struggling with the sort of aftermath and thinking about the 2022 JAMA article that did this big systematic review. I have worked on different projects with the people who wrote that paper, and I know that they are like the top of the top as far as quality research goes, but it's completely limited to outcomes measured at the individual level. So the health outcomes are mortality or survival or diagnosis of whatever, but they're all measured at the level of the individual. And so while they, you know, declared this, you know, very thorough review finding that there are protective effects, both in serious illness for quality of life and for health outcomes in population studies, I was struggling with how to do that at the same time that the Dobbs decision had just overturned women's rights in a way that was very religiously motivated, and the rise of Christian nationalism. And I'm saying to myself, how can we live in a society where, on the one hand, religion is a protective factor for individual health, and yet it's doing so much harm to our community at large? How can I explain that? And then there was the sort of medium level. So the way that I decided to think about it was to say, this research at the individual level is incontrovertible. There's nothing else to be said about it. You know, this is a protective effect for individuals in their lives, of especially religious affiliation. But in the middle, there are community groups. And we did in 2019 a special issue of the American Journal of Public Health on partnerships between public health and faith-based organizations, of which there are so many and such long histories, that are based in nutrition and reproductive rights and vaccine programs. And, you know, I sat here in this chair throughout the pandemic watching like National Council of Churches webinars with one congregation after another talking about how they did their vaccination drives. And they would do them with a toy drive at Christmas. They would do them with haircuts in the summer. They would figure out different ways to get people in to get them vaccinated against COVID. And so all of these efforts that I saw by faith-based groups were so much against what the sort of media narrative was. We did a paper on the media narratives and COVID that was really fascinating, really great project. I enjoyed doing it. But it was such a contradiction, and I was trying to sort it out in my mind. And then this is all taking place in a country where state power was asserting the religious views of some and enforcing them on everyone. And that's always wrong. There is no way in which the state we live in, supposedly we live in a state with free exercise of religion or not religion. And so the recent efforts to, you know, enforce those religious views about abortion on everyone is really, and more, is so wrong. So I was trying to fit like what I'd done my whole life into the changing world that we live in. And so we came up with a structure for the paper that differentiated the individual level of religion and health relationships and what the research showed there from the community level, where organizations often can find ways to work together in a way that benefits public health and at the same time do a lot of harm. I mean, there are community level problematic areas too. But at least it's a very mixed area where there is many, many examples of positive relationships between faith-based organizations and public health. But at the national level, at the state level, there's no good there. This was a way of explaining it. And in conversation with the co-authors, it was just, I learned so much from them, especially from Muhammad with the very many examples that he gave about vaccines in Africa and the opposition of religious leaders to those kinds of programs. So and HIV is another example of that kind of opposition doing a lot of harm to public health. It was a way of like me sorting things out. Mm-hmm. But I think that it is useful, a useful way to think about it, because you're right. You could just say, oh, no, I know so much about all the harm religion is doing to public health. And there's no denying it. But it helps to have a framework to understand it, I think.
Right. As you were describing your paper, what it made me think about is kind of the phrase that we use of like generalizability is the findings that we have in this like small pocket of society in this particular community. Can we take it and apply it in the same way in a different pocket in a different community? I don't think that we can't, as in like, you know, there's pathways maybe that religious communities build with the people in their communities to encourage vaccines or encourage certain health behaviors or beliefs. But it gets into almost like a bioethics of like, is it ethical to force this particular faith belief or this particular ideology based in some sort of scripture on another group that maybe practices a different type of faith? Maybe it's the same Christianity, but a different denomination. Maybe it's no faith at all. Like it gets into a conversation of at what point do we actually live into this idea of like freedom of religion? And it's not that we hate religion. I mean, both of us are faith people who are like tied to religious organizations. And also, how do we not use that as a tool to justify forcing people and harming people in the process? I think on that note, I want to kind of end our conversation with talking about religion as a risk factor, as we talked about, as a force that is actually creating barriers or increasing harm and having negative health outcomes. Can you help us understand how religion impacts society and policy and functions as a risk factor at that level? Can you say more about that?
Well, I think it's when it enters into policymaking of governments and when children are allowed exemptions from vaccines because of religious reasons, that is a problem. It's a problem for all of the vulnerable children in schools who are not yet vaccinated or who cannot be vaccinated. And so it becomes a risk factor for others. And so I guess, you know, refusing to wear masks during the COVID pandemic would be another example exactly like that. It's when this power of the state, this is how I'm just understanding it, that when the power of the state is used by religious groups to enforce their views on others, that's when we get into a problem. I don't know that I have a better answer for you. I mean, there are so many other examples that you could use, even at the individual level, of religious stigma and the kind of exclusion of people with different sexualities and other, you know, lifestyles that do a lot of harm to people, and mental health challenges that are caused by, you know, the exclusion from religious groups. There's much you could talk about at the individual level, more in the mental health area, I would say, and that has been less my own research area. But, you know, what can we do to protect against it? Well, I think that we need to recognize the limits. And when we've talked about vaccines in the past, there is a really great article by a guy who went, it's a very long article, and I think it's in the Journal of Vaccines. I could give you that link also, if you like, who really went through, there is no faith group whose religious teachings prohibit vaccines, mm-hmm. Not even Jehovah's Witnesses, not even Christian Scientists. And so it's such a learned article, and it really is, you know, sort of like the basis for it. So when there is religious opposition to vaccines, it's not based in their faith history. It's based in politics. And so we need to recognize that.
Do you have any suggestions or a hypothesis of where that line should be drawn? Like, if we're talking to policymakers, if we're talking to people in positions of power at this local, state, or federal level, what would you say is that line that shouldn't be crossed that turns religion from a protective factor to a risk factor and hurts health outcomes?
Well, when it's the beliefs of one religious group that are being imposed on others, that's against our Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so simple, and yet it feels like just everywhere you turn, there's like another policy, another law that's being implemented on like religious spaces. I was, as you were kind of listing some of the examples, I was thinking about obviously Dobbs' decision and everything that's happened around abortion care, but even IVF. Like, I think the recent Alabama Supreme Court decisions around IVF and what constitutes a human being, it's not just abortion, but it's even like families who can't get pregnant and need IVF, or queer families that want to have children that use IVF. And I also think it's important to highlight that obviously the U.S. has a very interesting structure federally in the kind of separation of church and state and the religious freedom aspects of our First Amendment. But there's other countries internationally that are also being harmed by the utilization of religion in their policies. I'm thinking about some of the most, I think it's maybe Uganda or DRC that has some of the strictest anti-queer legislations that is, I think, punishable by death. And a lot of it is, we could go on a long tangent, but a lot of it is linked to missionaries and colonization of Africa and the kind of embedded Christian ideology that has created these like anti-sodomy ideologies that creates punishable by death laws, which again ties to religion. Ooh, that's a big one. And I don't want to end on a negative by any means, but I do think, as I said, I think you're one of the experts on this topic. And I think there's an importance in both congratulating and celebrating religion as it is a vehicle for helping communities and individuals flourish, and also making sure that we have some safeguards to make sure that the train doesn't become a runaway and we turn into the Handmaid's Tales, because that's real too. So we can transition into our Furious Five, if you're ready for them.
Okay, sure.
Okay. I'm finding out that the Furious Five, I'm recording this out of order, but the Furious Five, the first couple are a little headier and then the others are much more simpler. So just stick with me for a second. If you could instantly solve one challenge related to the intersection of public health and religion, what would it be? And what would be the simple solution?
If I had a magic wand, I would just wave it and say, people in faith groups all over the world should know that there is no basis for opposition to vaccines. And child health is so important. And childhood vaccinations, which are now being affected by the opposition to the COVID vaccines, are going to damage. I mean, it's like our memories don't go back far enough to know that polio was affecting so many children. And so, yeah, we have these wonderful vaccines that protect child health, and we need to be using them. That's my magic wand, wave it.
I mean, vaccines are some of the greatest public health successes that we have. And it's mind-boggling that people are trying to contradict that. What do you believe is the most significant obstacle we need to overcome in the near future to improve this relationship of public health and religion?
Well, I guess I twist that question a little bit just to say that I really believe that interdisciplinary education for people in the professions of public health and in religion are essential to having people in those two sectors understand each other and be able to partner and work across some pretty big distances in many cases. So I feel like at a place like Emory, where we do this and we have people from public health and people from theology in the same room talking with each other, they get an understanding of the perspective of the professions that these people are both moving into. And they will have a level of trust and openness and also ability to communicate with the language and meaning of the kind of work that each other does. So I really do see that as a profoundly important tool. And I think sending forth a lot of people into the world that are going to have this in their background, it might be not in the forefront of what they do now, but they're going to have it there somewhere back there that is going to allow them to be the sort of brave person to reach out and be a bridge builder.
Absolutely. Oh, man, the idea of bridge building of, I call it being bilingual in two languages that don't speak to one another. Like we have to recognize the limitations of public health professionals don't know theological language, and faith leaders have to wear a lot of hats, and health educators often not one that they do well. And we have to be intentional about connecting those two islands. On the topic of religion and health, do you have any recommendations, whether it's a book, a podcast, a show, anything like that?
Oh, I do. I did think about that. So a really wonderful book from, I think, 2001, maybe, by the author Geraldine Brooks, who is an incredible writer. If you have read any of her books, The Secret Chord is her most recent one. She was a Wall Street Journal reporter, but then she has done a lot of fiction. And so the book is called Year of Wonders. It is fiction. It's historical fiction, but it is based on an event that really took place in the 1600s in England, in a little town that a traveling salesman came from London, where the plague was rampant, and brought a bolt of cloth that had, you know, it had the plague in it. And so this little rather isolated town in England, as people began dying, they went through all of the realizations, you know, that the plague had come to them. And they decided to isolate themselves for a year. And no one would leave the village, and they wouldn't let anyone in for a year. And the leader of this, the heroine is a young woman, but the vicar is a very charismatic vicar. And he's the one who convinces everyone that they need to protect the villages around them by not interacting with them at all. And so they did that for a year. And when they needed things, they had a stone or sort of a box or something, like a mailbox sort of, where people could bring things and leave them from coming from outside, and they could put things there and they could be taken, but they self-isolated to protect the community. And it is such a beautiful book, and his theological reasoning for it is so beautifully done. The vicar and the care that we have for our neighbors and the self-sacrifice that we make to protect others. I mean, it was written way before the pandemic, but it is really haunting and beautiful. And it turns out that in the afterword, she tells you that she was just on a hike in, you know, in the north of England, and she saw this little marker, and it was about, you know, the plague in this village, you know, isolated itself or something like that. And she made a whole story of all the characters. Of course, none of those people, or they don't, nobody would know who they were, but she invented a whole story based on just one little thing she saw on a hike. So it's a really beautiful story, somewhat rooted in history a little bit, tiny bit. Geraldine Brooks, Year of Wonders. I would also really recommend Cason Deaton's Deaths of Despair, which many of your listeners will have read already. But Angus Deaton has quite an interest in religion and has written some other papers that I've seen that may not have been published, but they were like working papers. But Deaths of Despair has quite a bit about the loss of religious ties in communities and how devastating that has been for the communities that have been especially affected by the opioid epidemic. So I would definitely recommend Deaths of Despair. And then if you want an uplifting, you've probably already seen, maybe you haven't, the Call the Midwife series, which is still running on public television. The Call the Midwife series is really about a community of sisters. So there were sister orders in the Church of England, and they had been nurses and midwives from the 1880s or so, I think. And they had, a mission in the poorest part of London, which is the docks. And when the National Health Service started up in 1948, they sent some of their midwives to work with the sisters who already knew the community, who were already delivering the babies there, but to help them. And so that wonderful show is just an absolute beacon, I think, of public health and outreach and sisterhood. So, yeah, that's a real public health and religion story. It absolutely is. If you've seen it at all, you know what I'm talking about.
That's amazing. I've never heard of it, but I will
never
add it
heard
to
of me. Call the Midwife.
I don't think so. No, but I'm excited to watch it. Where are you finding joy and hope these days?
Well, I didn't have any about 3 weeks ago, but now I do. So joy is the word, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think that's the yes. Democrats have joy. I think there's a whole new hope for the future now, of which I didn't see before. And I think that Joe Biden is an amazing president, and that he did what he did is going to allow us to have a hopeful future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's so much heaviness, I think, of what's coming down the pike for the next couple of months with the election. And I feel very similarly of just let's just hold our breath and hopefully we get to the other side in one piece. And lastly, where can people connect with you?
Oh, Emory email is a great way to connect with me. I'm on email all the time. So,
okay, we will link that in the show notes as well. Dr. Eidler, thank you so much for taking us on this journey and educating us on the topic that you are just such an expert in and such a pioneer in. I'm honestly just so honored. And you know, I'm like your biggest fan. And so I'm just happy to get to chat with you for an hour. As always, to our listeners, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening it. And you can also like the podcast, review it, share it with a friend. All of this helps a ton for our analytics. And stay tuned for a very exciting season that's coming. As I already mentioned, we're talking about abortion care. We're talking about climate collapse and environmental health, even access to like housing insecurity and affordable housing, things like that. So lots of things coming down the pike. I'm excited to take you on this journey with all of our guests. But Dr. Eidler, thanks for kicking off our season with such a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Alejandra. I love your pioneering work on this podcast. It's absolutely great.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Healing Theology podcast. We hope today's episode brought you new insights and inspired you to think differently about the intersection of religion and public health. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as it really helps others find this podcast. And remember to subscribe so that you never miss a future episode. For more information, resources, and today's show notes, and also to connect with us, please visit us at healingtheology.com. Until next time, stay curious, stay compassionate, and keep the conversation going.